For nearly a month, fighting has raged in a Palestinian refugee camp in northern Lebanon between an Islamist militant group and the Lebanese army. Besides the considerable human toll of the fighting, scores killed and thousands made homeless, there are concerns that the fragile Lebanese state could unravel, as it did during the country's 15-year civil war of the late 70s and 80s. The government has been nearly paralyzed for months in a mostly peaceful confrontation with the Shia group Hezbollah, which is supported by Syria and Iran and its Lebanese allies. But there are worries violence may escalate. Just today, an outspoken anti-Syrian legislator was killed in a car bombing in Beirut. For some perspective on the situation in Lebanon, we turn to Augustus Richard Norton. He's a professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University who's studied Lebanon for nearly 30 years. Norton is a former Army officer and West Point professor and was an advisor to the Iraq Study Group. He's the author of a new book, Hezbollah, A Short History. I spoke to him yesterday. Augustus Richard Norton, welcome back to Fresh Air. We're here to talk about fighting that now rages in and around a refugee Palestinian refugee camp in northern Lebanon. This is between the Lebanese army and militants from a group calling itself Fatah al-Islam. What do we know about this group?
Well, this group, Fatah al-Islam, is one of a number of Islamist groups that have prospered, actually, in Lebanon over the last decade or so. So this is a group that takes some inspiration from al-Qaeda. It also has been inspired by the so-called jihad in Iraq. In fact, a number of the members have participated in jihadist activities in Iraq. So this is part of a broader phenomenon, and it exploded about a month ago when the group tried to rob a bank close to the second major city in Lebanon, Tripoli.
And while they were being pursued for that, I gather they ambushed a Lebanese army outpost, right?
Well, what happened initially is that the Lebanese police tried to capture these guys. It was kind of a high adventure operation where they didn't really think about it very much, the police, that is. And they raided the headquarters of this group. And in retaliation, Fatah al-Islam then ambushed a number of unsuspecting Lebanese soldiers, killed a number quite brutally, gouged the eyes out of one guy, and really, it was really a horrendous. And already you've had over 60 Lebanese soldiers killed in the fighting. So this has been very serious.
Now, are the Fatah al-Islam members primarily Lebanese or foreigners?
No, it's a mixture. You have Palestinians and Lebanese. And you also have Egyptians and Bangladeshis and some Algerians. So really, this is a kind of a confab, if you will, of jihadists. You find similar groups in some of the other Palestinian camps, for example, in southern Lebanon, in the camp of Ain al-Hilal, where you have a number of these groups that have actually began developing in the 1980s, but have gained momentum over the last decade or so.
And do we have any reason to believe that they are actually connected to Osama bin Laden and others in al-Qaeda?
Well, I think there are some connections. The Fatah al-Islam in particular is more connected to the al-Qaeda subsidiary, if you will, in Iraq, so-called al-Qaeda of the Two Rivers. And they have actually sworn their fealty, their bayah, as it's called in Arabic, to the head, the prince, the emir, he's called, of that group. But, of course, the al-Qaeda of the Two Rivers in Iraq is in turn tied to al-Qaeda. So the connections there are pretty clear, it seems to me.
Now, you mentioned that Fatah al-Islam finds itself now in this Palestinian refugee camp in northern Lebanon. A similar Islamist group is ensconced in another Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon near Sidon. There are, I guess, between 200,000 and 400,000 Palestinian refugees in the country now. Why do these groups locate themselves among Palestinian refugees, and what is their relationship with that population?
Well, there are precisely 12 refugee camps in Lebanon. And, of course, these camps date back to the first Arab-Israeli War of 1948-49. The registered population is more than 400,000. The actual number of Palestinians in the camps is lower than 300,000. People have left for economic reasons and so on. But these camps are basically areas where there's very little economic activity. They're surrounded by Lebanese soldiers. Lebanese have a national consensus against what they call naturalization of the Palestinian population. So the result is that you have a lot of people who are sort of cooped up in what amount to outdoor prisons in these camps. And in that context, all of the different political trends found in the West Bank and Gaza are reproduced in these camps, and in fact, in many cases, are reproduced and exaggerated. So in Ain al-Hilwi, the largest camp in southern Lebanon, you literally have dozens of Islamist groups and secular revolutionary groups. These groups are oftentimes competing over small pieces of land within the camp. You have what amounts to sort of gang territories. So really, it's a reproduction of a Palestinian politics in these camps.
Now, the Lebanese army, of course, has responded to this with shelling and tank fire into the camps in their battle with Fatah al-Islam. You know, we remember that Lebanon has, for much of the past three decades, lacked a strong central government. Remind us who the current government of Lebanon represents.
Yes. Well, first of all, if I may say, the army response in northern Lebanon against Fatah al-Islam has provoked a strong national consensus of support in Lebanon. That, I suppose, is a hopeful thing. But in any case, the government in Lebanon today is dominated by a coalition of some Christians, many Sunni Muslims, and many Druze, who basically won the election of 2005 following the assassination of Rafiq Hariri, the former prime minister of Lebanon. One of the leaders of the government is Saad Hariri, the son, actually, of the former prime minister. And, of course, the prime minister is Fuad Sanyara, who was a longtime associate of Hariri. The opposition consists of a number of Christians, probably about half of the Christian community, Hezbollah, the Party of God, and other Shiite and various secular opposition groups, including the Amal movement, Communist Party, Syrian Social Nationalist Party, and so on. In terms of public support, my judgment would be, based on close following of events and a number of recent trips to Lebanon, that basically the opposition actually attracts a majority of support, probably 55-60% of the population, but the government is very much officially the government and in control.
And you mentioned that the government's response, its military response to the Fatah al-Islam group, has generated some sense of national unity. Does that include members of the opposition, the Shia, and the Christian, which have not been supportive of the government? Is this, in a way, tying this country together?
Yes, I think this might actually be something of an opportunity. The main Christian leader of the opposition is a former army general by the name of Michel Aoun, who's the most popular politician amongst the Christians in Lebanon, second only to Hassan Nasrallah in total popularity in the country. And he has called for decisive action by the army. And Hezbollah has also made strong statements of support vis-a-vis the army. So this is really an opportune moment because, as you know, Dave, there's been a stalemate in Lebanon for the past 7 months. The parliament hasn't been meeting. Basically, the political system and the economy, for that matter, has been immobilized. So I hope that actually this will be an opportunity to really build some bridges between the opposition and the government forces. To that end, the French have invited both pro-government and opposition figures to France at the end of June to discuss how those bridges might be built.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Professor Augustus Richard Norton. He is a professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University. He's an expert on the Middle East. He was an advisor to the Iraq Study Group, and he has a new book, Hezbollah, A Short History. Lebanon has long been this delicate balance of ethnic and religious groups. And in the late 70s, the country unraveled with suicide bombings and kidnappings and factional strife among militias that lasted for more than a decade. Are you seeing violence spreading in Lebanon now? And to what extent could this lead to another wider conflict, another civil war?
Well, the level of violence right now between Lebanese is very, very low. There have been 10 deaths since the demonstrations against the government began in December. So this is, of course, regrettable, but it's nowhere close to to the pace of killing that was going on during the Civil War, when about 150,000 people in all died over the course of 15 years in a country which then had a population of only 3 million people. So that's an enormous number of people. So the problem right now is the fact that there's a stalemate which has immobilized the country. Now, we fear, and I fear, that if that stalemate continues for too much longer, we could see an explosion of violence.
Creating a workable national politics, of course, is easier if citizens have prosperity. What's happened to the Lebanese economy with this fighting and with the fighting last year between Hezbollah and Israel?
The economy has positively tanked, and Lebanon is a country that depends on several sectors for its income. The banking sector, and much of the banking sector has been displaced to other places like Cyprus and Bahrain and the Persian Gulf. The so-called services sector, but particularly tourism. Last summer's war is estimated to have cost the Lebanese $2 billion in lost income. Some people say the number is actually much higher. And of course, this summer, you're not exactly seeing tourists flocking to Lebanon either. So from the standpoint of the everyday Lebanese, there's really a recession or even a depression underway. Mind you, this is occurring in a state in which half of government revenue has to be used to service debt. Lebanon, during the time of Rafik Hariri in the 1990s, made a big bet, if you will, a big investment in what it saw as a peaceful future. In the early 1990s, there was a sense that the Middle East was moving towards the resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. It was a time of great optimism. And as a result, the Lebanese, under Hariri's leadership, made enormous investments in infrastructure and so on, and repaired, you know, the ravages of the Civil War, many of the ravages of the Civil War. The problem is that cost a lot of money. The peace process didn't go where it was expected to go. It got derailed, as we know. And the result is the Lebanese are left with this enormous burden of debt. So the economy is really a major issue. And it's one of the reasons that some of these Islamist groups, like Hezbollah, for example, and the Shi'i community, have been able to generate a lot of support because they're frequently providing services that the government does not provide well or does not provide at all.
What are the lingering effects of the fighting last year between Israel and Hezbollah?
Well, the war caused enormous damage, particularly in southern Lebanon and in the southern suburbs of Beirut, where we find significant populations of Shi'i Muslims. Now, there are several things that are noteworthy. One is that many people are still waiting for a permanent place to live. There are about 15,000 families displaced by the war. But groups like Hezbollah have very much sort of benefited from the war politically, and that they have actually been, in many instances, much more effective than the government in providing services, subsidies, and so on. People I've known in South Lebanon, in some cases for 20 years, who were neutral, I mean, were pointedly neutral in political terms, after last summer's war, have actually gone over to Hezbollah because they saw the response of Hezbollah to the war. They'll even admit that Hezbollah provoked the war and perhaps did so stupidly, but nonetheless they see the response of Hezbollah to the war, and it's left them very impressed with the organization. Of course, there are many other problems that Hezbollah is not dealing with. For example, the Israelis dropped at least a million cluster bombs in southern Lebanon, particularly in the last few days of the war. And these are, of course, are being removed by international bomb disposal groups. They're only about 10% through right now. And that's part of the sort of lingering dangerous environment in South Lebanon, which unfortunately oftentimes has the effect of reminding people that Israel is their enemy and therefore that Hezbollah is a necessary protector. And indeed, for the people in South Lebanon, I would say if you ask them about their own security problems, and they have big ones, they'll tell you that they trust neither the Lebanese army nor the international force in South Lebanon, but basically Hezbollah, which they see as a much more effective provider of security.
Well, Augustus Richard Norton, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure to be with you again, Dave.
Boston University professor Augustus Richard Norton. His new book is Hezbollah, A Short History.